The Tory and Conservative Party was and is a peculiarly British creation which grew out of a certain attitude of mind, which is suspicious of passing fashions and too much theory, and believes in individual effort and maximum liberty under the rule of law. It is sceptical of big government, yet it is grounded in patriotism and pride in our country. It is a compass direction and an attitude, more than a dogma or creed, and it reassesses its approach in every generation. It has continued because it has never been an exclusive club and has always been prepared to take in people who, through circumstances or philosophy, have come to share its approach. The party of the left has changed regularly. There were the Whigs, then the Liberals, then the Labour Party, and we can already see the seeds of destruction in that party. The party of the right, however, remains not stagnant, but constant, still defending its basic values of freedom and opposing in each age those who would destroy them. Gilbert wrote,
"I often think it's comical how nature always does contrive that every boy and every girl that's born into the world alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative."
If Gilbert means that some men and women are born with a predisposition to defend existing traditional life and its values, while others are born to demand change, then he was partially correct, although the left-right division of politics goes deeper than that. The word Tory is an anglicised form of an Irish word. As the historian Macaulay wrote,
"The bogs of Ireland in the 1680s also afforded a refuge to Popish outlaws, and thus they were called Tories."
The name Tory was therefore given to Englishmen who refused to exclude the Duke of York from succession to the throne because he was a Roman Catholic. The term Tory, however, like many terms of abuse, became in time a term of affection, like old contemptibles. Historians, like modern economists, often argue, and there is no agreement, as to when the Tory party originated. Because the concept of party, a body of people united to pursue a common end, is relatively modern, and was first formulated by Edmund Burke in 1770. There were Whigs and Tories by 1679, however. In the elections of 1679 to 81, the Tories wore red rosettes and the Whigs wore blue, and the elections were fought with the noise, expense, anger, and fun of a 19th century election. The old Tory party was closely linked with land, itself a mark and symbol of continuity and slow, organic change. The party was determined to maintain existing institutions, political and ecclesiastical, and it had a high regard for law and order. Lord Falkland, in his speech on the Root and Branch Bill of 1641, said,
"When it is not necessary to change, it is necessary not to change."
We can argue about the word necessary, but it is a clear exposition of what conservatism is about. In the 17th century, the Tories tended to be ardent royalists and upholders of the Anglican Church. In the Civil War, they opposed the Puritans on the ground of religion as well as kingship. The Tories, like all good establishment parties, however, had to bow to forces which could not be beaten, and they accepted the 1688 settlement with William of Orange, arguing, as in the sermon of Bishop Atterby in 1701, that although men could not overthrow a ruler, God could use men as his instrument in doing so. From 1688, Tory loyalty to the crown was to an institution and not to the king as a person. There were some Tory Jacobites who would drink to the king over the water, but they were exceptions, and the divine right of kings in the person of each ruler died. The late 16th and early 17th centuries were the age of the anonymous song The Vicar of Bray.
"In good King Charles's golden days, when loyalty no harm meant, a furious high churchman was I, and so I gained preferment. When Royal James possessed the crown, and popery came in fashion, the penal laws I booted down, and read the Declaration. When William our King declared, to ease a nation's grievance, with this new wind about I steered, and swore to him allegiance. When Royal Anne became Queen, the Church of England's glory, another face of things was seen, and I became a Tory.
So the floating voter is by no means new. Under Anne, there was a brief Tory ascendancy, only to vanish in 1714 with the accession of the Hanoverians. Then followed 50 years of Whig dominance in government until 1760. The Tories, however, if not the establishment party, were the party of the country. The country gentry and the country parson were predominantly Tory. Dr. Johnson always said that the first Whig was the devil, and Squire Weston in Fielding's Tom Jones was the typical popular country squire. The Tories supported the church, the Whigs tolerated dissent. Lord Bute and Lord North were Tory prime ministers under George III, who succeeded to the crown in 1760. Lord North is often held responsible for losing the American colonies, yet the first years of his premiership were highly successful, and it is probable that no one could have prevented the eventual independence of the Americas. During the latter half of the 18th century, the philosopher Edmund Burke, who formulated the idea of political parties, had a profound effect on conservative political thought. He believed that the three elements of the Constitution, monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, must maintain a balance, and no one part must become too powerful or it would be corrupted. Burke placed great emphasis upon the importance of habit, custom, and instinct, and the individual in society. It was Burke who in 1770 wrote,
"When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall, one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle."
That is a lesson also for today. William Pitt the Younger, who can be classed as a Tory, was in office as Prime Minister for an unbroken spell of 17 years, starting at the young age of 24. Son of the Earl of Chatham, in Lord Rosebery's words,
"He went into the House of Commons as an heir enters his home."
He first presided over years of peace and promoted trade, reforming the customs dues, and generally taking note of Adam Smith's epoch-making book on economics, The Wealth of Nations. He was a strong advocate of the abolition of slavery and a close friend of William Wilberforce. In Pitt's last speech at a Lord Mayor's banquet after the Battle of Trafalgar, he denied that he was the saviour of Europe. He said that Europe was not to be saved by any single man, but that England had saved herself by her exertion and would, as he trusted, save Europe by her example. The French Revolution, like the Russian Revolution, had a profound effect upon people's attitudes to politics. It was Burke's reflections on the revolution in France in 1790 which brought his break with the Whigs. Many old Tories considered that established society and civilization were being destroyed in France, and Whigs moved to Tories as they too felt that the revolutionary ideas of France, propagated by various groups in this country, would undermine the principles of a civil society. The Russian Revolution has had a similar effect, and while it also has its groups of apologists in this country, it has moved many intellectuals and lovers of freedom to make a right turn and join the Conservative Party. The fight for national survival after France declared war on Britain in 1793 deepened the cleavage between the new Whigs, apologists for the French Revolution, and the old Whigs who had turned against it. However much Charles James Fox of the New Whigs could be hailed man of the people, the Whigs represented privilege and exclusiveness at the end of the 18th century far more than the Tories, who were much more open to all classes and talent. The Whigs, like modern Fabians, were the ones far removed from the ordinary person. It was said that for the divine right of kings, the Whigs had substituted the divine right of the aristocratic families who had made the 1688 revolution. Fear, both of the effect of the French Revolution and the depression in England which followed the Napoleonic Wars, caused Lord Liverpool, Tory Prime Minister for 15 years, to turn to limited repression to defend the established society. By 1820, however, general conditions had improved. and the Liverpool administration showed that it knew that we had, with the Industrial Revolution, moved into a new economic and eventually political age.
The general principle of free trade is the foundation of national prosperity,
Lord Liverpool said. In 1822, William Huskisson, who subsequently became the first fatality of the railway age, lowered tariffs and 2 years later legalized trade unions. Canning asserted the independence of foreign countries and, in supporting the independence of South American countries, coined the famous statement,
I call the new world into existence to redress the balance of the old.
It was Lord Liverpool who, by encouraging all talent in the Conservative Party, developed a glittering set of Tory politicians. The first Reform Bill, 1830-32, disfranchised the old rotten boroughs, enfranchising the new large industrial towns and cities, and added almost 250,000 voters to the electorate. The new middle classes gained a share in government, and both parties had to adapt to their demands. The Tory party even changed its name. In 1830, J. Wilson Croker, in the Quarterly Review, referred not only to Tories, but to the Conservative Party. Sir Robert Peel used the word conservative in 1831 and continued to popularise it. The middle classes, with their rising prosperity, had much to conserve. The Tories and Conservatives were both proponents of order, stability and patriotism. They both disliked abstract and speculative principles. They wished to make the enhancement of British interests and respect for our history the basis of their policies. Yet the Lords, the land and the Church were still seen as the basis of Conservative Tory strength, and in 1831 the Carlton Club was formed in St. James's. Benjamin Disraeli said that at times of great political change and rapid political transition, political parties found it convenient to re-baptise themselves. The Conservatives certainly did. And when Sir Robert Peel became Prime Minister in 1834, it was obvious that this was the case. Peel was proud of his un-aristocratic origins as the son of a cotton spinner and used these as a stimulus to others. He said,
Does it not make me... And ought it not make you, gentlemen, to do all you can to reserve to other sons of cotton spinners the same opportunities by the same system of laws under which this country has so long flourished, of arriving by the same honourable means at the like destination?
It is interesting that the Conservative Party has always promoted social mobility, while the party of the left has tried to keep a downtrodden proletariat as a stage army for its demonstrations. In education, in our own time, we have seen the Labour Party destroy, in the grammar schools, the ladders on which most of its leaders had climbed. Sir Robert Peel had a brilliant mind and was a careful Conservative reformer with great integrity of purpose and intellect. He had been a reforming Home Secretary, modifying the Criminal Code. He created the Peelers, the London police force, and he finally supported Catholic emancipation as the only means of preventing civil war in Ireland. His Tamworth Manifesto of 1834 was the first such manifesto in British politics. It committed him and the Conservative Party to follow the ideals of the Reform Bill. But his conservatism shone clearly in the words,
I will not follow every popular whim or abandon respect for ancient rights.
He simply promised a careful review of civil and ecclesiastical institutions, the correction of proved abuses, and the redress of real grievances. Thus the Tory party was rebaptized as the Conservative Party, and the Reform Bill was accepted. Both Whig and Tory could now laugh at the 1834 rhyme relating to Lord Verulam knocking down Lady Salisbury while dancing.
Conservatives of Hatfield House were surely harum scarum. What could reforming Whigs do worse than knocking down Old Sarum?
Old Sarum being the rotten borough of the old Salisbury before the Reform Act. The Conservative Party continued to absorb new elements. Lord Stanley, afterwards the Earl of Derby, was a Whig who in 1834 moved over to the Tories on the Irish question and became three times Prime Minister of a Conservative government. Peel himself represented the varied strands of the Conservative Party. A high Tory on the church, and for long on the Corn Laws, he was a liberal on social issues. His clear mind and determined purpose saw little point in office without power, and he used the 1830s, apart from his short spell as Prime Minister, to build up a party fully ready for office in 1841. From 1841 to 1846, Peel as Prime Minister laid the foundations of modern conservatism and succeeded in dispersing social unrest. He said,
"I have thought it consistent with true conservative policy to promote so much of happiness and contentment among the people that the voice of disaffection should no longer be heard."
It was, however, Peel's repeal of the Corn Laws in 1845 which brought his clash with another conservative of a different temperament and spirit, but who would be equally important in refashioning conservatism in a later age, Benjamin Disraeli. Sir Robert Peel believed that repeal of the Corn Laws would enhance the living standards of the ordinary person, improve the commerce of the country, and lessen social unrest. Disraeli and Lord George Bentinck believed that repeal would ruin the agricultural interest on which the Conservative Party had so long depended. That breach in the party meant that the Liberals would enjoy 26 years of government out of the next 30 years, and that in 1846, Peel had split the great party which he himself had built up. The argument on free trade or imperial protection would be a theme which would run for 100 years in the Conservative Party, with the party's moving backwards and forwards in its view according to circumstances. Disraeli, a man of Jewish descent, started as a radical and suffered two election defeats. He was attracted to a Toryism very different to that of Peel. His was a gorgeous Toryism, based upon devotion to the throne, reverence for the church, deference to the nobility, and genuine zeal for the common people. His ideas were both more aristocratic and more populist than those of Peel. His novels, Sybil and Coningsby, show his romanticism. They probably gave a more accurate account of industrial life at that time than the much-vaunted novels of Charles Dickens. Sybil, subtitled The Two Nations, is a bitter indictment of the life of working people in industrial areas, the two nations of the rich and the poor. In 1872, in his famous Crystal Palace speech, Disraeli said,
"The Conservative Party, unless it is a national party, is nothing. It is not a confederacy of nobles. It is not a democratic multitude. It is a party formed from the numerous classes in the nation. Classes alike and equal before the law, but whose conditions and different aims give vigour and variety to our national life. In my opinion, no minister in this country will do his duty who neglects any opportunity of reconstructing as much as possible our colonial empire and of responding to those distant sympathies which may become the source of incalculable strength and happiness in this land."
Disraeli summed up his aims as,
"The maintenance of our institutions, the preservation of our empire, and the improvement of the conditions of our people."
It is due to Disraeli that the Conservative Party came to be identified with the monarchy and empire and became the party of Queen and country. By sponsoring the 1867 Reform Bill, which gave the vote to the working man in towns, Disraeli dished the Whigs, and by his genuine respect and concern for the working classes, he linked very many of them with the Conservative Party. It was in April 1883 that the Times wrote that Disraeli discerned in the inarticulate mass of the British populace the conservative working man as the sculptor perceives an angel imprisoned in marble. The rapid growth of the conservative working men's clubs in the north were the product of Disraeli's genius and vision, and the conservative, and after 1886, unionist associations and organisations grew out of the need to adapt to the new age of increased democracy.